feel free to bring it up however you'd like to configure it, your presentation. While you're coming up, I'll take the opportunity to kind of explain that this is a continuation of a conversation that we began back in January. The committee's been very interested in how we can coordinate the responsibilities and activities of investments in Oregon to the in legal ways and ways that help the overall economy of the state. Mr. Salvaggio and I had some conversation about that, and I think he's ready to educate us on some new understandings.
Without restating for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. Without restating too much of what the chair already mentioned, Oregon Investments and Economic Development, generally in terms of Oregon investments, after coming out of 2008, our pension investments earned over 18% in 2009, and were recently nominated as the nation's best public pension plan of 2009 at the Public Pension Fund Awards for Excellence, overseen by the publication Money Management Letter. Speaking about economically targeted investments, there are several programs in place that facilitate in-state investments that can spur economic development in Oregon. I'll list a few. The Oregon Investment Fund is part of the Public Employees Retirement Fund. The Oregon Growth Account, which we feel is a very good model for early stage venture capital investment in state, and various opportunities also for private equity investments already within the pension fund. I will keep my initial comments brief and allow the committee to discuss more in depth whatever you choose to, and basically say that for each of these funds, for each of these opportunities, there are advantages, drawbacks, opportunities, limitations, and we will look forward to helping the committee navigate those waters.
Would you like us to ask questions, or the rest of you want to have some opening comments, or how do you want to proceed?
Chair Reed, if there are no initial questions, I do have Mr. Rich Bader here, who is a member of the Oregon Growth Account Board, who will speak to the performance, a little bit of the history and benefits of the Oregon Growth Account, how that has contributed to a venture capital culture in the state, and what it's been doing and what it hopes to do in the future.
Thanks for coming back, Mr. Bader.
Nice to be here, Chairman, Representatives. Nice to be here. Again, my name is Rich Bader. I'm a member of the Oregon Growth Account Board, and incidental to this process, also a member of the Oregon Innovation Council. I recognize the difficulty of the situation that you face, we all do, with the Oregon economy not performing as well as we'd like. I assume what's on your mind is what can we do in order to help stimulate the economy, get some job creation going, and so forth. And I think that both the Oregon Growth Account and the Oregon Investment Innovation Council try to accomplish those goals through different mechanisms. So I wanted to go through the OGA mechanism, and perhaps that'll stimulate some conversation. I think about the components of what the OGA does. One is the source of our funding. As you know, the funding to the Oregon Growth Account actually comes from the ESF, the Educational Stability Fund, which itself is funded by lottery money. This is the source of funding is important in that one of the unique characteristics of the Oregon Growth Account is eventually the state of Oregon, the Treasury Department, actually owns equity stock in these investment organizations that we invest in. And so we needed special permission rules in order to be able to do that. What the Oregon Growth Account does is invest in local companies in the state of Oregon. And we've had a range of investment policies over the years. Currently, we are focused primarily on early stage companies, very young companies, and give preference to investors that are located in the state of Oregon. Again, we believe that investing in these young companies is a contact sport, and that in order to make those contacts, you need to be here in the state. The outcomes of the OGA we measure are three ways. One is we make investments, we expect to get returns. Those returns come down the road. These are relatively long investment cycles for the money invested. We expect returns to come back anywhere from 3 to 7 years. So it takes a while for the money to come back. In the meanwhile, however, we measure one of the other metrics, which is job creation and economic development. And so the Treasury Office collects statistics now on how many companies have been created, how many jobs are being created, how much tax revenue is being created by these organizations that we are investing in. The third way that we measure our progress is by the development of the local investment ecosystem. And by that I mean the entrepreneurs, the suppliers, the local talent, the money that's necessary in order to nurture these young companies. And I would say that organizations like the Oregon Angel Fund, some of the growth of the Oregon Entrepreneurs Network, and there's a number of other metrics that I can, more anecdotal than quantitative, that I can point to that says there is more of a robust ecosystem that is now developing in Oregon. One of the things that we've seen recently at the OGA is some more innovative investment models that I think are better suited to what it is that we do well in Oregon, as opposed to looking at what they do in Silicon Valley or even what they do in Seattle and trying to apply those models to what the culture and climate really here is in Oregon. I can speak more about that if you like. But so, to come back to the top level, I think that as you look at the range of ways to spend money to stimulate the economy, there's loans, there's grants, there's economic development activities, there's also investments. We make investments. There's many ways to describe where we invest, but the OGA's focus is primarily on younger companies as opposed to more mature companies. It's startups. And again, the way we measure the results that we're going to get, longer-term investment returns, in the near term, job creation, and then overall the development of a more robust investment ecosystem in the state. With that, I'm open for questions.
Thanks. Mr. Embry, I just noticed you in the back. I'm sorry I missed you. We have one more chair up here if you want to join us. Since I think that sort of you are the last of the invited folks, and we can have everybody at the same time up here. Do either of the other of you have opening comments, or should we proceed to questions? Or how would you like to? Okay. Mr. Embry, do you want to make a few comments before we get right into questions? I'll start. I think there are others who will have some as well, but I know that the OGA has some different abilities and restrictions based on where the money comes from, but one of the questions that has motivated the committee, I think, at least some of us, is the question of to what extent we can apply some of those same flexibilities in other parts of the state's investments. Mr. Savagino and I had some conversations about that and some of the IRS rulings and so on. So I wonder if any of you would like to comment or would be willing to comment about how the different sources of funds are managed and how they're restricted in that way.
Certainly. Chair Reed, members of the committee. You are correct in that each fund has certain restrictions placed on it and certain abilities given to it as well, depending on where the money comes from and also what it's used for. The Oregon Growth Account comes from lottery dollars and therefore may be used for economic development purposes as provided in the Constitution. It sits in the Education Stability Fund, which, as Mr. Bader pointed out, means that it can hold venture capital. The pension fund is a federal qualified trust, and I think that that's where most of the restrictions that we mentioned come into play. And I can apologize, I didn't have this document beforehand, but we requested it from the IRS, and apparently they take forever to fulfill such requests. But we do have a revenue ruling federally that outlines that there is nothing specifically prohibited in the Internal Revenue Code in terms of what a qualified pension can invest in, aside from something that's already illegal, such as piracy or investing in murder or whatever. But
we don't have any interest in that in this committee.
That's fantastic. Being otherwise legal, there are four criteria that must be fulfilled before an investment is made. And I'll go over those four prerequisites. And that is, number one, the cost must not exceed a fair market value at the time of purchase. Number two, a fair return commensurate with the prevailing rate must be provided. Three, sufficient liquidity must be maintained by the trust in accordance with the terms of the plan, and that can vary according to what the obviously what the purpose of the plan is. And number four, which is more general, the safeguards and diversity that a prudent investor would adhere to must be present. Once those four criteria are met, there is nothing stopping us from making a economically beneficial investment. But I'll just refer back to the discussions that we've had offline and put that on the record for committee, that those four criteria must absolutely be met first, or we do run the risk of having our trust fund unqualified by the feds.
And I have a number of questions about that that you also know, so that we've sort of previewed, but I don't want to go too far down that road. So let me ask if there are other questions from the committee before we go too far. Representative Greenlee.
I think we'll get down the road with those as well.
Yeah.
I'm particularly interested in some issues around the Oregon Investment Council's decision. I'm really taken with what Mr. Bader said. Mr. Embry and I have had some of these conversations before, as did Josh and I earlier today. The Investment Council has a set of different investment criteria based on different components of the investment strategy, including the 10% investment target in alternative investments, and inside that, one-fifth of that relating to venture capital investments. And there is an interest on our part in investing whenever possible in emerging Oregon industries. And there is the spectrum of companies involved, from very early investments, as you were talking about, angel investments, into more modest investments, and then into companies that are getting more ready to take off. There seems to be a gap in the gamut of investments for us. There seem to be some of the really good ideas at the very early stage and some early investment, but what doesn't seem to be happening to allow the council to move towards $100 million we've suggested ought to be invested in emerging Oregon industries. So part of that is the ability to bring deals that allow you to make those investments under the prudent investor concepts. I think one of our tasks is to figure out how to help you complete that spectrum. If there is a sort of hole in the middle of it that's stopping us from getting the kind of deals in emerging Oregon industries that are proper under the criteria for the investment council, what can we do to help stimulate the environment, to help stimulate the ability of people to take those deals without having to move their company to the Bay Area or to Seattle or to Texas or to Boston or somewhere? And I think when we're looking for what legislative agenda to have for the 2011 session, I think that's really high on what we can do to help that happen.
That might have been a better opening for this general discussion than I was able to provide. Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
I'll take a shot at
it. Okay.
Chair, Representative Greenlee, there's a couple of things that you're addressing. One is the funding gap, and right now my assessment is that there's a pendulum, right? Of is there too much money, not enough money in the range of investments, and right now it's very difficult to get money. It's very difficult as a startup. It's difficult as a mezzanine company. It's difficult as a later stage company. Banks are not lending as much, as you know. So in many cases, the leverage, the value of having the state bring some more money to the table right now is a good time to make those kinds of investments. Second thing I'd say is, in terms of the spectrum, there are a number of us that do think about the spectrum of investments and opportunities as you've described. Part of that is the role of Oregon Inc. Part of that is the role of OIF. Part of that is the role of OGA. I believe that the OGA, over time, where we invest has shifted. We have shifted to early stage because we noticed a very huge gap in terms of getting companies started in the state. And secondly, the relatively small amount of money that OGA has to invest, we felt would be best applied to that problem. As you move into later stage investing, the number of zeros on the ends of the numbers increase, and the OGA didn't have much to bring to that. I would say that we can certainly expand the scope of our investments and do think about how do our early stage investments get follow-on money. That's a concern that we have. Most of what's happening now is that early stage investing is being done in companies that we think will get to cash flow positiveness without any additional money. If they can get it later, terrific. But the prudent investment right now is to get them to a point where they can either be acquired or run on their own profitably with a very small amount of money. If you were to consider spending, increasing the spending, and remember OGA's spending was cut in half recently, if we had more money to invest...
Although not all of us voted for that.
Let the record note that, Chairman. Thank you. If the OGA did have some more money to invest, one of the things we could consider doing is expanding the range of investment opportunities that we have and look at later stage investing as well. OIF could do the same thing. Oregon Inc., while not investing, plays a similar role. And I think having that conversation is a good one to have. I do think that the OGA could play a role in that regard.
If I could follow up.
Please.
But the House Bill 3613, which we passed 7 years ago, did put a target of $100 million, which is a few more zeros than one more zero than you have.
Yes.
Targeted towards emerging Oregon industries, which might be that mezzanine or for the next. I mean, you're talking about risky investments with a high potential yield, and that's a prudent investment decision if it's inside the proper allocation place. We're talking about things a little less risky and a little less payoff, and how do we make how do we make those investments? How do we get those investments to be made, whereas they appear not to be made now for a variety of reasons? Out of that $100 million, we've targeted toward that.
I'll give you a part of the answer and then defer, Chairman Representative, to my colleagues here for the other piece of it. Part of how the OGA invests is determined by the legislation that you've passed. There were amendments made to the chartering legislation for the OGA that had encouraged us to invest in earlier stage investments. We embrace that legislative mandate and craft an investment policy that guides how we invest the money at the OGA. So the opportunity for you to provide guidance to either us or the OIF or any of the other investment vehicles is through legislation translated into investment policy. There may be an opportunity to gather some of these folks together and say, okay, this is what the legislative's intent is. What are the best vehicles for us to be able to achieve this goal? And I think reasonable people would be happy to get together and have that conversation.
We did that, though.
With regards to the
OIF.
We
did provide that opportunity. It's the ability to turn it into action that's been the problem.
Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee, I think that's a fine question, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this constructively. And the thing that makes venture capital and private equity unique among investment classes is that for public equity and to a lesser extent for fixed income, you can pretty much march into a bank or an investment advisor and pick that off the shelf. Obviously, private equity, whether it be established, venture, middle stage, is going to require a larger amount of due diligence. And Mr. Mueller from Treasury can speak to that. I would point out that we have made great leaps forward in terms of how much we have invested within Oregon Venture Capital, not only through the Oregon Investment Fund, which was created by the Investment Council as a tool to get to that goal, but also just through our private equity placements outside of the Oregon Investment Fund. But in terms of how do we speed this up, how do we grow this and make it even more robust than it is, maybe even speed things up a little bit, what Mr. Bader was speaking about earlier in terms of creating a culture of venture capital within the state, that's another thing that we are trying to make the investment fund get into. The treasurer last year through an event called the Big Idea Bash, which was an effort to connect opportunities and capital together. And these kinds of events, I think, could contribute to what Mr. Bader called that, venture capital ecosystem.
Yes, the investment ecosystem.
The investment ecosystem. And obviously, it's not, if we're shifting gears to start to look at this ecosystem, obviously that's not something that's going to happen overnight, but in terms of what the legislature can do to spur that along, the growth account can certainly help with that. The Economic Development Department can, I don't want to speak for them, but I imagine that would be up their alley. And we'll continue to make that kind of effort with the investment fund as well. So we're looking not only at how can we place these dollars in the state, we're looking at also how can we create this culture and make these ideas also come. There's a metaphor that we had in terms of what the limiting factor here is, and like Mr. Bader said, it's a pendulum, swings back and forth. Is there too little? Is there too much money? But if you think of opportunities and ideas as the bread in your sandwich and the capital is your peanut butter, you can have all the peanut butter in the world, but if you have four slices of bread, you can still only make two sandwiches.
Yeah, so, but I can eat the others with a spoon.
And some agencies do. So the intent here is not only to make sure we have enough peanut butter, but also to create a culture in which we have slices of bread coming into the state as well. And so I think that some of the things that we're doing on both the OIF side and Mr. Bader's side are contributing to that.
Worried that we're turning into the Agriculture Committee here and that the economist in the room is going to assume something soon. I want to get back for a minute. Well, first, is there going to be another bash?
Representative Reed, Mayor Zucconi, I certainly hope so. We have talked about having additional bashes. Of course, we haven't been able to plan anything during the legislative session.
Understood. I want to get back for a minute to the four criteria that you mentioned. I think I have an understanding, anecdotal and primitive, though I'm sure it is, of prudent investor liquidity. But the first two, the cost that doesn't exceed the fair market value, and I was trying to keep up with the way you were speaking, I wrote down return, which I think was sort of fair return or equitable return or something like that. Can one of you speak to how that's established on something very early? Maybe it's a revolutionary new product or service that's difficult to compare to something else. So if the person or group who's making the decision says, here's something we really believe in and think is going to be a great thing to invest in, whether it's the OGA or the Oregon Investment Fund or anything else, but there isn't anything to compare it to particularly, how would you proceed?
Go ahead. Chairman Reed, representatives, that's hard, is the short answer.
Yes.
And that's why the OGA hires professionals that are paid to do just that. A significant portion of the negotiation between the investors and the company is about the valuation of the company and its value before the money is invested and then after the money is invested. Like with real estate, there's comparables. Like with real estate, there is the how frothy is the market right now, and then there is a little bit of Kentucky windage and how motivated is the buyer and how motivated is the seller, and eventually a price is reached, and that is the fair market value by definition.
So the risk, though, if I'm understanding it, if we're not sticking to those criteria, is the tax exempt status, is that right? Or what happens, I should start with that, what happens if you made an investment that didn't stick to those criteria? Please.
Representative Reed, members of the committee, I'm Cynthia Burns. I'm with the Attorney General's office, and I represent the Treasurer's office. Used to do more investment stuff than I do now, but I'm generally familiar with some of these principles.
Thanks for returning to your roots.
Yeah, that is where I started out. First, I think if it's all right, I'll explain sort of the framework within which OPERF and the other state investment funds operate. For OPERF, there are a number of layers that all sort of coalesce around a prudent person investment standard. OPERF is created as a trust fund by statute for the sole benefit of the beneficiaries, which are the retirees and active workers that are contributing to the fund. With that trust status comes sort of three layers of law. The first is common law as it relates to trusts that requires trustees to invest for the benefit of the beneficiaries and to operate the trust for the exclusive benefit of its purposes, which in this case is to provide retirement benefits. The second level is statutory, the set of ORS that govern the PERS plan and the investment standards under which OPERF is invested. Those statutes, by and large part, mirror the common law in terms of requiring prudence and productivity in investment of the trust and a duty of loyalty. And then finally, the third level is federal law. And that is primarily the law that governs the tax-exempt status of the trust fund. And again, that turns primarily on an exclusive benefit standard, which by in large part reflects the common law duties that are imposed on trustees. So the four factors that Mike outlined are one of the tests or the sets of tests that the IRS can look to see if a trust fund is being operated solely for the exclusive benefit of the beneficiaries. There are a number of different rulings that in different fact situations have applied similar sort of standards or measures to determine whether the trustees are operating for the benefit of the fund. And so in terms of the market value, that's one of the factors. In those instances, you wouldn't want to have a trustee who was operating a fund for the benefit of his company and putting monies into that. You know, it's. I think it would be rare that and I don't know that it's happened except for perhaps with a very small retirement fund, not comparable to this one, where there were two beneficiaries and the fund had one investment, which was in the trustee's company or something like that, that one investment would jeopardize the tax-exempt status of the fund. What's more likely to jeopardize the tax-exempt status of OPERF is a set of statutes or policies that violate that exclusive benefit rule.
That's helpful, and I didn't mean to suggest that we'd be doing that way, but just that I didn't mean to presuppose what the risk would be, but rather to ask if we weren't sticking to those, what would the risk be? I was guessing, so maybe I didn't get that right.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I think that you know if you had a broad set of statutes and policies in place that were openly targeted to promote the economic development of the state of Oregon as opposed to retirement benefits for the beneficiaries, that would be something that would disqualify the plan. If that happened, you would lose your tax-exempt status, which would result in lots of bad things. Lawsuits from the retirees, for one. Extra taxes that the state would have to pay for all that stuff that was previously tax-exempt.
Chair, can I follow that question?
Sure. And then Representative Garrett.
That notion of exclusive benefit, I think, is an interesting, as opposed to benefit. I mean, we're seeing newspaper articles that our PERS accounts are $1 trillion down. So when the notion of including investments in emerging Oregon industries was tried with the representatives of the beneficiaries, the public employee benefit unions, they were very interested in having this happen because they recognized it was in their best interest for the future of their investments, for the future of their pensions, to have a healthy economic environment in the state of Oregon. Now, that's not exclusively for their benefit, any more than you pay them a pension is exclusively for their benefit. That's the benefit of the grocers and the other people who they spend the money for, but it is in their benefit. And how come that can't count, or can that count, in the notion among the benefits that would accrue to the pensioners or to the future pensioners?
It's Cherry, Representative Bailey, or Greenlinks, I'm sorry, members of the committee. The way the prudence and productivity standard and exclusive benefit have been standards have been applied in the case law are to look at those standards solely in terms of risk and reward and monetary direct monetary benefits that are paid to the retirees. For OPERF, the purpose of the fund is to provide a set of monetary benefits to a retiree, and it's having the funds there to pay those benefits that is the purpose of the fund. So the case law and the Internal Revenue Code rulings have said that those sort of collateral benefits that benefit the community as a whole in which the retirees live is not an allowable criteria in and of itself to place an investment.
Except the allocation model has a whole range of risk-benefit combinations.
Representative Bailey, members of the committee, that's true, and part of that goes into part of the prudent person investment standard is to have adequate diversification. So in part of that diversification, you can, you know, there are lots of ways to diversify, and that can be based on type of investment, maybe even area of investment, but it folds into the whole diversity is part of a strategy of investment that's both prudent and productive.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Garrett, or you had a follow-up?
I'm not related to this. I just had some comments in general. I think for the record, I'm Mike Mueller. I'm the Deputy Chief Investment Officer for the Oregon State Treasury, work in the Investment Division, and I'm the staff member to the Oregon Growth Account. If I might, there seems to be an assumption running around that there's not enough capital, and I'm not sure that I accept that assumption. And we seem to be looking for pools of capital because of this insufficiency. And let me point out some numbers just relative to the Oregon Growth Account, which has been around since 1999. And I've been staff on and off over that time period. Since the inception of the program, we've made commitments of $97 million to general partners that will look in Oregon for investments. Not all of that money is from the Oregon Growth Account directly, but because of leverage, $112 million has come directly into Oregon companies since the inception of the program, even though only about $55 million has come directly from the OGA. Of the amount that we've committed to these partners, and if you understand private equity, not if you do, otherwise I'll go into a brief explanation, we make a commitment of, say, $5 million over a 3 to 5 year period. They'll call that money down as they find investment opportunities. We still have $42 million that we've made forward commitments to that they haven't yet called down. They meet with entrepreneurs every single day, and there are entrepreneurs, and maybe this is a big secret, that don't deserve to be funded. They don't like to hear no. They hear no multiple times, and it gets frustrating. And not every deal ought to be funded. Not every general partner ought to be funded. We've funded 20 general partners or partnerships. 12 of those are based in Oregon. I would dare to say that we've met with every general partner who is located in Oregon and has an interest in investing in Oregon. Mr. Embry can attest to that. We've met several times over the last several years, and in fact made a commitment to one of his funds of $5 million, and the OIF made an $8 million commitment to the same fund. So there's capital available. And to Representative Greenlick's question, it's at all stages. Capitalism is good at finding opportunities, and money comes from out of state all the time. You can pick up the Portland Business Journal and see private equity groups making $10 million investments in Oregon companies. And you can pick it up for the last couple weeks, and I'm sure you'll find a couple such transactions.
It's Mr. Bader that said there wasn't enough money, not me.
No. But Representative Greenlick, my point is, I'm not sure that we need to seek other sources of capital when it's there are issues and conditions related to it when it comes to the trust fund of the public employee retirement fund.
Well, I appreciate those comments. Maybe go back to a combination of what Mr. Bader and Representative Greenlick said around the ecosystem and making sure that both sides of the equation are in balance. That's at least my interest. Representative Garrett.
Thank you. A follow-up question on the legal explanation that you provided. I'm trying to understand, I hope this makes sense. Is the prudency requirement, is that a threshold requirement after which then there is discretion to choose among investments? Or is it really a spectrum so that the legal obligation is always to find the most prudent investment? Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, Representative Garrett, members of the committee. The prudence and productivity standard is sort of a threshold, and arguably it's a threshold with different levels of risk and reward, because you need to also have, as any sort of prudent investor would say, diversity. So you look sort of first, if you have two investments, you sort of look to those and say, well, which one is better in terms of risk and reward? And then actually the Internal Revenue Code rulings and case law say that if you find two investments that are equal in terms of risk and reward, and one of them has a collateral benefit like economic development to Oregon or something like that, it's fine to invest in that. But your first goal is finding the best reward for the amount of risk you're taking.
And Chair Reed and Representative Garrett, I would add that it's not an investment in isolation. It's in total. It's a portfolio perspective. And I think that's also reinforced in ORS 293.726, where it talks about what's a prudent investment. So not in isolation, but the portfolio taken as a whole.
Thanks. Other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While it may not be exactly germane here to the discussion, the opportunity presents itself for me to inquire as to this balanced ecosystem, why participants in PERS are not members of the Oregon Investment Council. And I just think that would balance this whole ecosystem a heck of a lot better than it currently is. Certainly, the participants in that pension plan, I think, would meet the four criteria. They certainly would be viewing that as their economic security, their economic future, and I think would seek a fair return and act as a prudent investor. So. I'm just wondering, again, this whole balanced ecosystem.
Chair Reed, Representative Witt, members of the committee, that's a fantastic question. I welcome the opportunity to delve a little bit deeper into the structure of the Investment Council and how it works with the rest of the state. The governor is given authority to take one of those Investment Council slots for, I think, a member of the PERS board. If I recall correctly, we can be a PERS participant. Point out that the treasurer himself is a PERS participant, as is the director of PERS, though non-voting. The Oregon Investment Council, however, invests not just the pension plan, but many other state funds, including the, for instance, the Oregon Short-Term Fund, the Common School Fund, etc. And along with each of those investment duties that they have, there is, in most cases, I'll call it an ancillary board or commission that then is composed more along the lines of the actual purpose and intent of that fund. For example, the Oregon Investment Council has the duty to invest the Public Employees Retirement Fund along the policies and criteria set down by the PERS board, which does have PERS members sitting on it. They invest the Common School Fund according to the policies established by the land board, and they invest the short-term fund with under the advisement of the short-term fund board. And each of those boards are composed of members with more of a connection to the purposes behind those respective funds. But certainly to the meat and potatoes of your question, I'm certain that we'd be very interested in having that continuing discussion regarding, how can we make the council more responsive, and how can we make sure that we're working not only with the OIC, but also with the PERS board. And I think having the PERS director on there serves as a great link in terms of, right now it's Mr. Cleary answers to his board, and then also can bring that to the investment council as necessary.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably slightly off from what you folks have been helping us understand, at least me. But would any of you change our current structure, the structures you've been talking about, given the economic difficulties it now faces? Because it seems that the design of the systems that we've been discussing fit pretty well 4 years ago, and maybe today doesn't. And so are we, in your opinion, stuck with the design of the systems you're describing here? Because of what all the safeguards we have in place, because there's a lot of them, I'm glad they're there. I'm just asking you guys if you think we should have more flexibility, or do you think that what we have in place is just fine and we need to wait this thing out?
I'm sure we members of the committee, Representative Benz. I'm sure that Mr. Mueller is itching to discuss it, or perhaps not. But
it looks rather indifferent. Oh. I'd like to hear it.
Okay.
Okay. I'd be happy to share.
Sure. Certainly. But I'll just go over initially that I'd like to point out, again, we were nominated for nation's best large public pension plan. Our competition for that, Indiana and Kansas, recently dropped in terms of their actuarial funding level. So here's crossing our fingers, hoping that we win that. I don't think anyone...
Does it come with any monetary reward?
Mike, do we get a statue or something?
We do.
A statue? We win. And what's the fair market value of the statue? I'm just kidding.
I don't think anyone's going to be concerned over more flexibility in the ability of the investment council and the treasury to respond to market forces. But in terms of changing the fundamental structure, I'll let Mike speak to what he feels is necessary.
Chair Reed, Representative Benz. I would say that obviously from your standpoint, the call to action seems to be necessary. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with the pieces that we have in place right now. Relative to the Oregon Growth Account, I think it's serving its purpose. We continue to meet with general partners who will serve entrepreneurs who bring new ideas to market. I don't know that my concern is the unintended consequences of trying to seek a solution that may or may not be in the best interest of either the beneficiaries or the state in the long run. When we try to get probably too creative in the potential solutions, and I think you used the word, do we just wait this out? That may be the best course of action, as painful as it may be for several years.
Mr. Embry.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, Representative Benz, a couple of things, and I'll actually kind of bring this around and tie it back to Representative Greenlick's original question. The irony of all this is the best startup climate I've seen in the almost 25 years of it in the venture capital business. It's actually been it's a very remarkable time. The quality of the entrepreneurs, the quality of the ideas, the engagement that they're getting with large potential customers is quite unlike anything that I've seen before. I agree with Mr. Bader that unfortunately the amount of money available for this part of the asset class is too little. There's plenty of money in Oregon. That really isn't the issue. The issue is how it's allocated and is it taking advantage of the opportunities. The situation I think we find ourselves in, and one that Mr. Mueller might be surprised that I absolutely agree with him. I don't think the issue is how much more do we try and wring out of the staff, the Treasury, and the OIC. It goes back to this ecosystem issue. The reality is very few other organizations and entities which have the ability to invest in early stage opportunities or private equity in the state actually make those investments. And that to me is the bigger challenge. It's not that the opportunities don't exist. Over the last 2 years, we've invested in 9 companies, half of which are located here in Oregon. So outside of ourselves and the Oregon Angel Fund, we've been the most active investors in the state. And ironically, those two entities, we have the smallest pools of money. So we've been making the most out of small dollars, getting tremendous leverage out of that money, something on the order of 25 to 1. And so the opportunities are there. And I think the if there's a suggestion I would have for this body, it's how to find a way to engage the other organizations and entities that have capital that you know could be investing in Oregon but aren't, and have that discussion. It, you know, I think the reality is, you know, Mr. Mueller and his staff spend a disproportional amount of time for a relatively small amount of money they manage under the growth account. Now, personally, I agree. I think anything should double the amount of money going into the growth account during this particular time, because the opportunities are there. And if we wind up waiting until the market's frothy again to invest, we will buy high and sell low. And that's going to be fatal. It'll be damaging for the economy, and it'll be one of the worst things we could do. We really do need to be investing right now.
So what do you have to follow up on your comments then? You mentioned the need to engage others. Do you have ideas that we ought to be considering?
Representative Reed, members of the committee, I mean, we do that on an individual basis because we raise money from individuals, family offices, and small endowments and foundations. So you know, we do those, you know, frankly, one at a time. But the reality about venture capital business is it's a numbers game. It's volume. So the one of the things that you'll hear from people about Oregon and other places is, well, we don't have as many successes. Well, there's some irony when you look deeply into the numbers. The reality is, and I think I showed these data to the committee a few months ago, the number of IPOs, the percentage of IPOs, rather, the percentage of failures and the percentage of mergers and acquisitions is the same across the entire country. It's amazingly uniform, regardless of your location. So the venture capital model is somewhat homogenous in that regard. And so it really comes down to, you know, you need more at-bats to get on base.
Appears we're clearing out the room. I don't think it's any commentary on the nature.
I've heard I have that effect.
I don't think it's you. It's probably me wanting to delve into a subject that doesn't hold the same level of interest for everybody else.
You can spice it up if you like.
Please.
One additional comment as well. A lot of this has to do with one's motivations and how you measure the results. And the professional investors are beholden to their stakeholders, and by and large, the returns, the way that they are measured is in money, pure and simple. When we have an economic situation like the state faces now and the role that you play, it is different than the private investors, the people with the money, who our investment strategies are largely dependent on to work with together. Our goals are not necessarily in alignment. So while this economic situation suggests more economic development and job creation, perhaps at the sacrifice of absolute returns, some of the other private investors might not necessarily share in that sentiment. So then the question is, what means do you have, perhaps other than investments, leaning more towards economic development activities where you can spend some of that money and get the job creation to happen? Now, again, it's a spectrum. So some investment funds are held to higher standards, like OPERF is, in terms of federal requirements, and which restricts how much flexibility they have. OGA, I would say, has more flexibility than they do, while still we are an investment fund. Economic development, on the other hand, we have a wide variety of ways to spend money to help stimulate the economy, but we do not expect a direct return on that investment measured by the investors. That's the spectrum of tools that I see at your disposal, and while we certainly wouldn't want to compromise the retirement benefits of our public service employees, I recognize the need for you to take some action in order to better stimulate the economy. I think the OGA is a vehicle for doing that. I also think that Oregon Inc. is a vehicle for doing that, albeit difference between them, Oregon Inc. is not an investment fund. We're not looking to measure the direct results from that. And then, of course, there's the more traditional economic development activities that you can be funding as well.
Mr. Chair, can I ask Mr. Embry a question? I'm sorry I had to step out.
That's fine. Go ahead.
And I have a committee meeting I'm chairing next door.
Simultaneously.
Were you, when you invested in emerging Oregon industries, those nine things, were you doing that for economic development of the state of Oregon?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, Representative Greenlook, I'm as avowed capitalist as anyone. We invest locally because we live and work here. We know the opportunities, we know the marketplace, and we have an economic advantage investing locally.
So you're even suggesting those were prudent investments?
More than suggesting.
And how come you can find prudent investments that are in emerging Oregon industries, which by their definition will create jobs, I think, and other people are having a little trouble finding them?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, you know, the venture capital business is feet on the street. It really is a local business. And if you look at the numbers, the vast majority of dollars over the last 10 years have increasingly gone to Silicon Valley, where the vast majority of venture capitalists are located. However, what's interesting is over that same time period, we've dramatically distributed the intellectual capital in this country. The percentage of dollars going to Stanford and Berkeley and those locations are actually declining compared to the regions, if you will. And so there are as many good ideas outside of the Bay Area as there are inside the Bay Area. Unfortunately, the capital is becoming more concentrated inside the Bay Area. But from our perspective, we've had long-term relationships in the region. We're able to capitalize on those relationships and make use of them.
If I may add one other comment, Chair Representative Greenlit, let's imagine that I had an investment opportunity for you where if you gave me $100 million, I would generate $200 million in 5 years.
At a certain risk ratio.
At a certain risk ratio, at an acceptable risk to you.
WorldCom was when it was an investment grade stock, for example.
I will presume that you might respond to me, you know, I don't have $100 million to invest, so then maybe that investment opportunity isn't the right one for you. I just presume for the sake of the argument. I also might have an investment opportunity where I said, if you gave me $10, I'd get you $50 back. And you might say, you know, that's really nice, but actually I've got $10 million that I need to invest. Getting $50 back isn't going to move my needle one iota. So within the spectrum of venture capital, we have a range of investments that need to be deployed and a business model that each of these venture capitalists puts together on their own.
No, I would say, if you're asking me about my personal investment, let's say it was $10 million that I had. I'd invest $3 million in growth stocks. I'd invest $2 million in international stocks. I'd invest $3 million in government securities. And I'd probably invest a couple of million in alternative investments. And maybe half of that would be in VC. So I'd have $1 million, and I'd go out looking for $1 million investments. And if I were going out and looking for it, I wouldn't be out looking for Oregon investments in Safeway, or Oregon investments in Walmart, or Oregon investments in a real estate trust that buys downtown buildings. I'd be looking, because I believe my money ought to be used in a socially useful way, I'd be looking for a prudent investment in an emerging Oregon industry that would produce jobs in the state of Oregon and returns for me. And that's what we've asked the Oregon Investment Council to do with $100 million. Instead of doing that, what they did was they brought Credit Suisse in and gave them $100 million to invest in Northwest Investments, whatever that means. And they brought in some private managers and asked them to invest in Northwest and other investments, whatever that means. Neither of them were asked to specialize in looking at and putting feet on the street for emerging Oregon industries. And we've asked for a list of what are the Oregon emerging industries, and I expect we'll get it soon. It's not here yet. I understand there's been a little trouble developing it. So I'm just, all I'm asking for is, how'd you guys do? Did you really, how much of that went into Safeway, or how much of that went into emerging Oregon industries that were good, prudent investments that, that would meet a federal challenge?
And
that's
maybe
all.
I can add to that question just a little bit by, it sounds like there are a couple of different models that are out there. It seems that the one that we're using, for good or for bad, is finding the I think the general partners was the term you used, who then go out and find the individual investments. Is it appropriate, or would it be appropriate for the legislature to provide more resources to the Treasury to take on some of that role? Is that a bad idea? It's just, I hope that's kind of in line with your question as well.
Yeah, what can we do to help?
Chair Reed and Representative Greenlee, to answer your question, it's a possibility, but what we typically do is we hire outside experts. We could build an internal staff. Credit Suisse, for example, is a multinational corporation with offices in New York and by definition around the world. They do these kinds of things, not just for Oregon, but for several other states.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I do want to make one point, though. It sounds like from if we accept Mr. Embry's point, the sort of feet on the street, does Credit Suisse have the same expertise if they're elsewhere in the world on what's going on in Oregon?
Chair Reed, they have an office in Portland. Dave Almodovar runs that office. He sees all of the same general partners I do relative to the Oregon Growth Account. The fact of the matter is there aren't that many opportunities to find qualified general partners with the feet on the street to invest in these companies. Investing is an easy endeavor. You find somebody with a great idea and you give them the money and hope that they execute it well. What I'm interested in is getting my...
Come on now, that's a... I mean, you mean that in a cynical way, right?
I
yeah,
do.
I can find somebody out on the street. You're not talking about, I'll go out in the street and give them money out there.
No, I think, Representative, I think he was saying that the giving of the money is the easy part, the finding the right place.
The giving of the money, I can find entrepreneurs that we could line up out the door that have a great idea, but for,
they think it's a great
for
idea.
For need of money, it would be the next Google, eBay, PayPal, what have you.
In their opinion.
In their opinion. The fact of the matter is, and Mr. Embry knows this from investing, a big chunk of those investments go to zero, and you hope that a small portion turn out to be pretty good and make the fund. Relative to the Oregon Growth Account, we've been doing this since 1999, and while we've had some success such that we could return $18 million to the Educational Stability Fund, if you look at it in terms of dollars invested versus what's our investment worth today, we're underwater. It's
You're not the only one.
Well, but the point is that it's not so easy just to invest money, create jobs, economic development, and get back one and a half, two, three, maybe 10 times your money. You can put your money out there and get back none of it, which has happened to us, or a smaller portion of it. So I just want to be clear that there's not a rampant opportunity that we're missing, and that if we just do X, Y will be the result. There's a lot more factors than that. And relative to your example, in a diversified portfolio, I doubt all your public equity that you mentioned. In fact, you mentioned international equity, you measured government bonds, and you mentioned venture capital would all be located in the state of Oregon. And likewise, when we build any portfolio, we're restricted
it,
in...
It was the $1 million I talked about in that. I said the $1 million out of the $10 million, just as about what you said, 10%, I would invest in alternative investments. I don't have a problem with hiring Credit Suisse. I don't have a problem. What I have a problem is not tasking them with the job that you're claiming you're tasking them with. I read the RFP originally. I read the original deal. I didn't have to get a public information request. And there was nothing in it that talked about emerging Oregon industries. I read the RFP they sent out for finding partners. Nothing in it said anything about emerging Oregon industries, and asked them to report the extent to which they have been successful among their investments in finding emerging Oregon industries. That's the only problem I have with this whole thing. Sure, hire Credit Suisse, because they bring money along, mm-hmm. their own money.
Chair Reed, Representative Greenlee, members of the committee, I think in terms of the concerns regarding linking the Oregon Investment Fund performance to
the relevant statute, 293.733. I think it's important to note that the Oregon Investment Fund, though one of the strategies in reaching the statutory recommendation of $100 million, was not a direct creation of that statute. The investment fund does target Northwest in general and has brought tens of millions into Oregon, leveraged hundreds of millions into Oregon, but also, like you've alluded to, has made investments in Washington, some in British Columbia, and it's important to note, though, that is not a statutory creation, that one of the strategies that we use to get up to the $100 million.
It's important to note, if I may, Mr. Chair, for the record, that you were tasked to do a certain thing, and you were tasked to do it inside prudent decisions, and you may or may not have succeeded, but you haven't produced one lick of evidence that you've responded to a seven-year-old statutory requirement for you to do. And that's what's frustrating me. I don't know if it's frustrating anybody else. And you don't have to tell me how many jobs you've created. You don't have to tell me any of that. It's like in the health side, when I provide somebody money to do smoking cessation, I don't ask them to prove that they've stopped cancer deaths. I know if you get people to quit smoking, downstream you'll reduce cancer deaths. I also know if you can find successful investments in emerging Oregon industries, that'll be good for the economic development. But I'm not asking you to prove the economic development. I'm not asking you that. I'm just asking you, have you done what we asked you to do, and how's it going?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, that's a fantastic question, and I think it is also important to note that the $100 million benchmark that the representative refers to, we are absolutely getting there. I think the representative's concern is how fast and how effectively we get there, and the point that there is a very specific objective that we're aiming for is well taken. However, in the relevant statute, we do have a responsibility written right into Section 1 that we need to ensure that it's prudent to make those investments. And
I know, I wrote that set. I know what's in it.
All right.
Thank you for reminding me.
I Chair Reed, members of the committee, I apologize for if any of that was seen as disrespect.
It's not seen as disrespect, Michael. It's just, we're frustrated.
Representative Greenlee, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I need to go chair a meeting next time.
Thank you.
Thank
you for your multitasking.
Gets away, and I pick on Michael, which I don't really want to do, and I apologize the extent to which he feels picked on.
I appreciate the fact that you can multitask, and the fact that your passion for this question comes through every time.
It's Michael, something that we love that you, share. Guys. Really.
Representative Reed, Representative Greenlee, I'd like to put on the record for committee that I came to Oregon in 2002 and was not associated with, but closely
right next
involved
door
with the campaign that brought Representative to our area, and have worked
indeed
with his office ever since. And I know him to be very very strong feelings about improving the state in terms of both economic development, especially health care and whatnot. And I know that everything that he's doing.
I think it's time to paraphrase that. Like the end of Casablanca, right? This is the continuation of a beautiful friendship.
Thank you, sir.
Both between these two gentlemen and your assembled wisdom and the committee. It's clear evidence now that you have the subcommittee that's especially interested in this. But I appreciate your willingness to stick, and I hope that we can continue this conversation. I think we're all interested in the same things, and we want to figure out how to help. So I think I've clearly exhausted the attention of the committee and the agenda. And
Representative Gilliam, you have some questions?
Now that Representative Greenlee's out of the room, I'd like to dissent.
Thank you very much. We will close the informational meeting, and unless I have to say anything else, if I've done this before, where I should adjourn before I should present anything else, and we'll adjourn the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.